Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another edition of the Gagan Pod where Michael Bridges has pulled a hammy in the warm-up. So I am alone, joined by Socceroos' most capped ever player, Mark Schwarzer, as we try and make sense of that farce of a Champions League draw that happened last night. We look back at the controversial penalties from the weekend. We talk all things A-League and Schwartzy shares the story of a former teammate involving goals, trophies and suitcases full of cash. All that and plenty more coming up on the Gagan Pod. What's happening, guys? Welcome to a very special edition of the Gagan Pod. I'm joined by one player today, Marky Schwarzer. But what more do you need, really? It's myself and Schwartz trying to dissect all the latest news in world football. Schwartz, you're joining me from London. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, mate. You?
Yeah, good. Can't complain. No Bridgie bleeding our ears with his nonsense today. And Tommy's taking a week off as well. So it's just you and me to try and make sense of, firstly, probably the biggest breaking news that everyone's talking about. I was driving to work today and still hearing on the radio, you know how Australian media is, the radio station giving the wrong Champions League fixtures out. I heard this morning on the way here, they were like, and there's a dream draw in the Champions League. Ronaldo meets Messi. I thought, no, there's not. Sorry, Triple M getting it wrong. But the Champions League draw had to be redone, Schwartzy. What was the reaction over there?
Farcical, really. Disbelief that they can get it so wrong. I mean, there's obviously still fallout because the simple fact is Real Madrid, Perez is not happy, you know. And in years gone by, Real Madrid wouldn't have cared because they're that good. They would have always seen themselves as the main contenders of winning the Champions League. I think now they look at it and go, well, the first draw they got Benfica, now they've got, is it PSG?
Yeah.
So, yeah, they've got good reason to be worried, let's be honest.
And apparently the biggest ones were Atletico Madrid. So they're the ones that caused it to be redrawn, because as soon as it happened, they got Bayern. And I think that's the biggest thing about it. They got Bayern. Now they've got Manchester United. Will they be pretty pleased with that?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I absolutely believe they will be. Bayern, for me, are still one of the favourites, albeit they didn't play very well on the weekend. However, they're still a formidable side, top-class side. Man United, we can see, is still a long way off being a top-class player, team.
And your former club, who you play Champions League football with, Chelsea, drew Lille twice in a row. Now, they could have drawn Bayern Munich, they could have drawn Real Madrid, they could have drawn so many top teams. Not to take anything away from the French champions, but they've got to be pretty pleased with getting Lille twice in a row.
100%. And you're right, you know, you can't underestimate any opponent. I mean, we saw it a couple of years ago, Lyon do so well, knocking Manchester City out in the quarterfinals over in Lisbon in that knockout kind of tournament format that they had during the pandemic. So, I mean, I know a one-off game as opposed to home and away is very, very different, but I still believe, listen, Chelsea haven't been firing. As we all know, they've struggled of late. They've sort of limped over the line at times. They've had a couple of disappointing performances in between. But obviously the Champions League knockout game is still a couple of months away. But they'll still be looking forward to that. They'll be looking at it and going, you know what, we are in a favourable draw, but they've still got to go out there and perform, because Lille, you cannot brush them aside. You can't think that they're just going to be easy beats, because they won't be.
No, not at all. And as a player, you've been in obviously Champions League campaigns, Europa League campaigns. Do you watch the draws? And are you texting Absolutely. The boys during it, like hoping you get these guys? Don't want them. Like
Absolutely, you are. You know, generally a lot of the times you're at training when the draws are, because they're obviously mid sort of morning, so you're finding out as you're out on the pitch. Or you may even delay going out. I remember, I think it was with Fulham, we may have even delayed slightly going out to training just so we could see who the opponent was going to be in the next round. It's huge, absolutely, because you look at it and you can see a path then, you know, you start to see, okay, who's been drawn against whom, one of those is going to be knocked out, then all of a sudden the draw sort of opens up a little bit and you kind of go, okay, right, this is our game. We've got to get through this. Then something could happen. You know, who knows what's going to happen the next round. However, you've got to, obviously, as it is, you take it each round as it comes, the draw, the way it is. But Chelsea, be delighted. I'm delighted for Chelsea. Man United will be a little bit worried. So the rest of them, you know, Man City, Liverpool, I think they'll be reasonably pleased.
Pretty good for the English teams. Yeah, Man United will be the one that are worried against Atletico Madrid. For you, Schwarzer, when you're watching Champions League football and you see Diego Simeone's Atletico, is that a team that you just hope loses? Because you met them a few times in your career and they were such a formidable, I mean, always world-class strikers there. UEFA Cup final, Champions League with Chelsea. They just kept popping up, didn't they?
They did, and they were a bit of a nemesis for me. And you're right. I mean, unbelievable strike force all the time. You know, I only ever got one draw out of them, and that was it. I lost two and drew once. And, yeah, very, very tough. They just knew how to win games. Very, very good technically. Top class players. But they're not the same, are they? They're not the same team as they were, you know, even 2-3 years ago. So they're a side that, you know, have struggled a little bit of late. Players, there's a bit of unrest. I think for Simeone now, it's one of the most testing periods of his time at the club. You know, he started that rebuild, had a lot of money, they injected a lot of money into the club, and a lot of those buys haven't really, I mean, João Félix is the prime example, haven't really, well, they haven't developed, they haven't delivered. And I mean, all the talk is now they're prepared to listen to offers for João Félix.
Yeah, it's insane. I always find it interesting when a manager like Diego Simeone, take nothing away, he's the highest paid manager in world football as well, which is remarkable. His salary's huge. But when he's such a, everyone knows the way he likes to play football, and then you go out and sign one of the brightest young technical players, it almost feels like a bit of a waste for him being there.
Yeah, but if you look at the amount of money that they spent on that one player as well, it just it's incredible, really. I mean, you know, they got rid of Griezmann, they let him go, and they obviously got a lot of money for him. More reluctantly let him go. They had to in the end. And it just sort of seemed a little bit of a panic buy in terms of going out and buying João Félix. Almost like an opportunity to try and show that they mean business. There's intent there. We're going to replace. Obviously, we've lost an absolute brilliant player in Griezmann. We're going to replace him with the next best player coming through. And there's always room for that to kind of not come into fruition, to fail. And certainly with João Félix, we've seen glimpses, but we've not seen the player that I think Atletico certainly were hoping they were going to see.
Yeah, huge opportunity for him. The storyline's all over that one. Suarez back at Old Trafford, and of course Cristiano Ronaldo against a team where he's broken their hearts on several occasions, got a very good record against them. So there's plenty to look forward to. But you'd say the biggest fixture in this really is PSG up against Real Madrid. It's a huge game. Everyone's going to hope that Sergio Ramos is back playing week in, week out for that game. Messi against Real. Mbappe against the club that he's so heavily linked to. It's early days, but who do you see taking that one?
I have to fancy PSG, I think, at this stage. I know Real Madrid have opened up a big lead now in Spain. PSG haven't been at their best. I don't know. I just, for some reason, I'm for no other reason other than I'm just feeling like it's PSG at the moment, slightly favourite. But I think you can go with either of them. I think it'll be a really, really entertaining fixture, or two fixtures, in entertaining tie. Slightly leaning towards PSG, like I said.
PSG got all the superstars to do it. But do you think when it comes to European competition, when you've got Pochettino and you've got Ancelotti, who's won this several times, does that make a huge difference in the dugouts?
It can. The only thing I'd say is Ancelotti hasn't won it for some time, right? And, you know, Real Madrid are certainly not the team they used to be. You're right, PSG is certainly not firing. Messi's not the same Messi as he was at Barcelona. Probably still pining for going to go back to Barcelona. Yeah. Mbappe, a lot of speculation about his future, which looks more and more likely that it's going to be away from PSG. So yeah, there seems to be a lot of different angles on this one. You know, let's be honest, will Pochettino even still be manager by then? You just never know, do you? I mean, if PSG don't really sort of, you know, perform well and take the lead position in France, and, you know, take it by the scruff of its neck and make it their own, then Pochettino could be in trouble.
Huge. I can't wait. No one can wait. Champions League football. And what makes that interesting as well is when Champions League comes back, there's always pressure on the Premier League clubs having to then back up and play huge games in Europe and then huge games in what looks to be a super tight title race. I'm going to go back to the Prem now. The weekend, Schwartzy, was remarkable. I mean, watching that, Chelsea, City, United, Liverpool, all winning with what I can say were questionable penalties. What was the reaction like in the UK?
Well, I think it's the first time that all three have had penalties in the same fixtures on the weekend and all three have won. I mean, you know what? I know with certainly people always say the big teams have all the luck and everything else, and sometimes it's momentum, sometimes it's dominance of possession, attacks after attacks, and referees get caught up sometimes with the flow of the game. Not for me, because it's a big club, but it's the flow. You know, it's the constant pressure of attack after attack after attack, and eventually there's a decision that goes their way. I mean, it happens less and less these days in terms of dubious decisions because of the way VAR operates, but it's still, there is an angle of interpretation, right? So you're going to get it. You're going to get times where you're still going to question whether decisions are the correct ones or not. Listen, all three of them are incredible size. Chelsea obviously not firing on all cylinders, but they're scrapping and they're fighting and they're rolling their sleeves up and they're trying to dig in massively. And I think for them it was important to get the win, as it is with Man City and Liverpool. And the thing about it is, it's the three teams that you kind of, I said at the beginning of the season as well, and I think all of us agreed, it's going to be between those three. And hopefully it stays like that until the end of the season, or at least as close as possible to the end of the season. Because, I mean, what an incredible season it will be if all three of them are vying for it coming into the last couple of weeks of the season.
It reminds me a little bit of that title race that you were a part of, right, where Jose labelled you guys as the little horse. It ended up just being 4 points between the three of you. That must have been an incredible season. And, you know, he likes to play those media mind games. You guys were slightly out of the race come the last few weeks, but you influenced the race massively with that game at Anfield. Does it remind you a little bit of that title race?
There's elements of it. The only thing I would say to that is that these three teams are all genuine contenders. So All three managers are there and expecting their teams to go and win. Whereas Jose in the back of his mind probably thought, yeah, we could, but you know, the pressure is really on for next season. This is a side where we can possibly go on and do something. We can possibly get to a Champions League final. We can possibly, you know, take it to the wire, the Premier League, who knows. But it was more about the way that the whole season was played out and the way, the tone that Jose had. And he always said, it's next season. Next season is when we're going to win it. And that's when Chelsea went on to win it, right? So I think this time around, all three of them are throwing their hat in the ring and all three of them are expecting to win the title. And it's going to be incredible to watch it unfold. And like I said, I just hope it goes all the way to the wire, because what an end it will be. Remember the days when it was Man City, Man United, and You know that game, Man City at home to QPR and scoring in the whatever overtime it was. Man United's game had already finished. They thought they'd won. You know, we want that drama back again. And let's hope that all happens again, but Chelsea win it.
I couldn't agree more. I'd love to see it. That game, I've always wanted to ask you about your game at Anfield, and just like, it was, I remember watching that. It was a remarkable result when you looked at the lineup. No disrespect, but you looked at the starting lineup and you thought, wow, it looks like Jose's rested. If you remember, Thomas Callas was playing in front of you, and that was one
of his debut. That was his debut in the Premier League as well.
Right. Look, you know how it is here in Australia. This is full of Liverpool fans, right? And for me, I think I really enjoyed giving it to them the next morning. But they were blowing up when Mark Schwarzer was taking his sweet time on a goal kick after 15, 20 minutes. Yeah. What was the tactics like that day?
I think I lost a lot of Australian fans that day. and to this day, still, they've never forgiven me. And then obviously doing a thing with Optus Sport about the slip, they're still really, really upset about it, I have to admit. What was it like? The tactics on the day was very much that. Go out there. Listen, we're the underdogs. We're here to try and spoil the party. We can possibly come here and win. That's the idea. That's the ideal scenario. But we're here to do a job. And if we frustrate them, then maybe something can happen. And we stay disciplined and well, you know, good shape, work hard. You know, things can happen. And we had a talented group of players. Obviously, not a group of players that played that day necessarily going to be vying for the title. Absolutely not. But in terms of a one-off game, there was always an opportunity, and we went there and right from the off, the manager said, listen, take your time, frustrate the crowd, frustrate the players, and let's just take our time. And then we will get we'll have opportunities. There will be moments in the game where we'll have opportunities. It's just how we manage the rest of it. And, you know, it worked perfectly for us. We managed the situation really well. We frustrated the fans from the minute almost the referee blew his first whistle. The players were annoyed all the time. Yeah, I copped untold amount of abuse from Liverpool fans, from players. It was a tactic, and a tactic that in the end played its part in helping us win as well.
Looking at that game, I mean, you were huge. Thomas Kalas making his debut didn't look like it away at Anfield. We've seen now Jose Mourinho at Roma, and he's given Christian Volpato a debut. We spoke about that the other day, and his ability. Afena Gyan, 18-year-old earlier this season, scored a double coming in off the bench. Was he, in your career, one of the best at getting that out of young players, new players, and just being able, as a man manager and a motivator, was he the best you experienced?
Yeah, definitely one of the best. He was right up there with giving you an enormous amount of confidence, self-belief going out there and well, convincing you that he trusted you. Whether or not he actually genuinely did or not is another thing, but he gave you that belief that he trusted you, and he believed that you could go out there and perform at the level that he needed you to play your part. So he did that very, very well. I mean, listen, that's all part of management. You know, you got to manage the squad of players that you have at your disposal. And that's what I think he did very, very well. And with the squad at the time, I think we were kind of probably achieved probably close to the maximum that we probably could have that season. And like he always said, you know, it was always the next season. You could bring in a few players, strengthen again, and then that's where they're going to kick on. And that's actually, in the end, what happened.
Unbelievable that he's predicted it as well. That must have given you guys so much confidence going into the next season. And like, you're right. I mean, you look at this title race, it is a three-horse race, but I don't think you'll have either of these three teams going to an Anfield or going to a Stamford Bridge and parking it from the first minute. They're so attacking, these three. They're so, and it looks like they're all throwing their hat in the ring to win it. But I do want to bring it back to the Prem just quickly before we move on the penalties. I wanted to ask you, this weekend, we saw plenty of them. Rudiger going down on Rafinha's tackle, Salah going down very easily, City's handball penalty, Ronaldo in the box. Which one of these was the weakest penalty in your opinion?
Which is the weakest one? Gosh. I mean, I think they've all got a case to answer to, that they could all be down there. But, you know, that's the thing of these decisions, these instances are nothing new. The only thing people sort of kind of now have a problem with is the fact that VAR is there, and you should see that it's a genuine dive or so little contact. But the problem you've got is with the video analysis, checking over the incident, is that you see every little bit, slowing it down in slow motion. You see every little bit of contact. So therefore, if there is a genuine contact, therefore it warrants enough. If the referees initial call is, I think there's enough contact to warrant him going down. Yes, he did go down easily. However, I still think, and that's, I mean, it's all open to interpretation. What was the softest one? You know what? Gosh, I mean, I don't know. I mean, Mo's was pretty soft.
Yeah.
But then I thought they were all pretty soft, you know? Yeah. So I'm not even going to put one, I'm not even going to point out one of them. I think they were all pretty soft, but you know, it doesn't matter. If any of them were on my team, you'd be congratulating your teammate for getting that penalty.
Yeah.
So it's not even a case of I don't think there's any, you know, people always, like a lot of people always straight away say there's cheating involved. That's, you know, the player cheated to win. No, I don't agree. It's sportsmanship to a degree. It's fine line, but there is contact, and I think there was contact with all of them. There was a level of contact with all of them. So therefore, for me, they're well within their right to slightly over-exaggerate, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, and like you said, they've got that relentless pressure. All these teams were on top. All these teams were creating chances. They had the possession stats, and eventually something's going to crack. It might be a penalty in the box. I want to talk about Man United, Ralph Rangnick, three games in charge now. two wins and a draw in the Champions League, so unbeaten. It's a pretty good start. They haven't lost a game since Ole Gunnar Solskjaer left, but scored one goal in each of these games. And when we saw his formation, partnering Cristiano Ronaldo up front now with Marcus Rashford, with two attacking flair players behind, you thought this was going to result in goals, goals, goals. But is this a good sign for Man United fans, or should they worry at the fact that they're struggling so much to put the ball in the back of the net?
I think they should be happy with the fact that a new manager's come in, has a different idea, and he's got results immediately. Mm. Whether it's 1-0, whether it's 2-1, whatever it is, as long as they're getting results. And the rest of it will come, I believe. You know, the players need a little bit of time to adjust. The work rate of the Manchester United side has 100% increased because it's far better than it was beforehand. They certainly seem a lot more organized, and the players seem to be taking on more responsibility and being more accountable for their performances, because I don't think they were before that under Ollie. I think Ollie at times probably gave him too much free rein, and there wasn't enough accountability put on the player's shoulders. Whereas with Ralf Rangnick, for me, from the outside, it looks like the players realize that, yes, the manager gives us the instructions, he picks the side, but there's an element of a huge amount of responsibility for the players to go out there and perform each week. And so far, I think it's been really positive of how hard the players are working.
Yeah, I guess you'll take them. 1-0 doesn't matter. As long as you're winning games, I think the United fans will take it. They've got a good run of fixtures.
Take it for the meantime, because I think that can change very, very quickly if there's a prolonged period of time where there's that 1-0 and there's a 1-1, they end up losing games. They will start to get then pretty rowdy after a while. But I think initially it's a positive sign. And I've got no doubt United will score goals. There's no doubt about it. It's whether or not, defensively has always been the issue at United, certainly over the last couple of seasons. And that's obviously still an area of concern. However, they've certainly tightened up on it massively.
Yeah, David De Gea has been in inspired form as well, which has been huge for them this season. It's good to see him back to his best. I wanted to talk to you about another game that happened this weekend. There's more misery on Everton. We spoke last week about the fact that their director of football has left and there's massive pressure on Rafa Benitez. They travelled to Selhurst Park and they lost 3-1. But what I wanted to speak to you about was Conor Gallagher, who's been in incredible form this season. He's a Chelsea loanee. He's killing it. We're supposed to have Michael Bridges on here. I was going to speak to Bridgie about this because he's been a loanee a few times in his career. I know you haven't, but you would have experienced loanees coming into your club and you fall in love with them, the fans fall in love with them, and then they've got to go. Is that something that you've experienced in your career?
On the odd occasion, generally a lot of the times with loanee players, Jeremy was one player we signed from Chelsea. And had a fantastic first season with us, and they were desperately trying to sign him permanently, and he ended up leaving and he didn't stay with us. I think he went to Liverpool actually. So they were bitterly disappointed in that regard. So he was a real success story. Olivier Decourt we signed at Fulham, and he was signed from Inter Milan. Roy Hodgson still had obviously some connections there. Olivier Decourt in his time was a phenomenal player, but he struggled when he came to us. He was nowhere near the pace. We had no longer certainly the physical ability to keep up with it in the Premier League. So it didn't work out. And then you could see with him, he got incredibly frustrated because in his mind, and at moments on the training field, he was heads and shoulders above a lot of people, right? But put him out on the Premier League pitch, on a match day on a weekend, he struggled. Mm-hmm. He really struggled. Mobility wasn't there anymore. And that was someone, an example where it certainly didn't go to plan.
If you pick up a loanee that maybe is coming from a slightly more, not successful, but a bigger club, and they're coming on loan, do they have a different mentality? Do you ever find that they don't want to get injured and they don't really fit in as much because they know they're only there temporarily?
No, not normally. All the ones that I had experience with, certainly if you sign at the beginning of the season, they were fully committed. If they played really, really well and they got towards, maybe three quarters of the way through the season, then if there was opportunities for them to move on afterwards, then sometimes on the odd occasion, there were ones that kind of went hiding a little bit. Then all of a sudden had injuries and therefore were just more worried about protecting themselves and making sure that they didn't suffer any bad injuries between then and the end of the season. Certainly if they knew they weren't staying at the club anymore.
Well, Conor Gallagher is flying for Crystal Palace and the fans absolutely love him. But there has been already talk thinking if he continues this form, could he return to Chelsea? Could he force a move into the starting lineup? I mean, is he at the moment superior to a Mason Mount, a Kai Havertz, a Hakim Ziyech? Or has he still got a long way to go?
But I think he's a very different player to those guys, you know? I mean, they're more creative players. Connor's more of a player that, I mean, certainly his work rate in midfield is phenomenal. Yes, he's able to get to the edge of the box. He's kind of, for me, he's more of a mould of a Frank Lampard-esque. You know, certainly not at that level just yet. But what I'm saying is that work rate, box to box, get on the end of stuff and trying to get a goal here and there. I mean, Frank obviously scored a lot of goals. I mean, that's a different level. But it's just kind of in that direction. I'm not gonna say he's a Frank Lampard, but he's in that direction. So I think he's a different player to a Mason Mount or a Ziyech, certainly, and Kai Havertz and all that. These guys are more players that are certainly more advanced up the pitch. They can play out wide, can play in behind your number nine. Whereas Connor, I don't think necessarily that's the most suited position for him. Would he fit in? Would he come in place of or complement? So, like, if you look at it now, where would he fit in right now with Chelsea? Would he come? Would he actually play ahead of Jorginho? No. Would he play ahead of Kante? No. Where would he get in front of Kovacic when he's fit? Probably not. However, then there's the next lot, Loftus-Cheek. Would he play ahead of Loftus-Cheek? Probably. No. I could see him playing ahead of Loftus-Cheek, actually. However, Loftus-Cheek's done really well this season at Chelsea. And the one thing I'd say about Chelsea is that, you know, 3 years ago now, I would probably say there's got no chance of going back to Chelsea and playing. Mm. But now, I would say there's every chance that he has an opportunity to go back and stake a claim in that Chelsea side, if he continues to play like he is now till the end of the season.
So is that because of the Frank Lampard effect? I mean, you were at Chelsea at a time when so many great youth products left the club. Is that a difference in mentality? Was that always the plan, or do you think Frank changed that as manager?
No, I think there's a combination of things. So it was circumstances. There was the transfer ban. So the club had no option other than to look towards youth, to try and find a balance between the established players they already had at the club, the experienced players, and then trying to blend in the youthful players, the players through the academy, maybe the players on the fringes that were, you know, out on loan, see which one of those would come back and actually make a difference, could be able to step up and progress to another level whilst playing at Chelsea. Mm. Obviously, the great examples is, Tomori did really well. Mason Mount, obviously Tomori's gone off now. Reece James, when you see the way he's come through. So Frank was obviously at the helm at the time, and he was given that as part of his task to get the team in the Champions League position, but also allow these young players to come through and have some experience in the first team. Years gone by, even a year before that, that was never going to be the case, unless they were exceptional, unless they were out of this world. Because the level of players that came to Chelsea is always at such a high level, and they want instant success. Whereas, you know, 2 seasons ago under Frank, it was, yeah, we want to try and get success, but we need to balance it with now bringing some young players through because our hands are tied right now at the moment.
And the success was actually frighteningly instant with a win in the Champions League, right? I don't think anyone saw that coming. So maybe it is a change in mentality, but you have to commend that Chelsea Youth Academy just seems to be spitting out world-class players year by year now.
Well, I think we're saying that now because they've got a genuine pathway into that first team, because I don't think 2 years ago they genuinely did.
Okay.
There was a pathway, but it wasn't a genuine pathway into the Chelsea first team. There was a pathway elsewhere, mm-hmm. out on loan elsewhere. It was the model they went with. You know, it's very successful. Whether you look at certainly the players that they brought through the academy and then sold on elsewhere, went out on loan and then sold them off. I mean, if you look in the summer now alone, they sold 5 players to fund Romelu Lukaku coming in.
Yeah.
You know, and some of those players were part of the academy. So it's part of the system that they have in place. And now I believe there's a genuine pathway. Now I don't think they're no longer are they afraid of bringing any player directly from the academy into the first team. Whereas previously, I think they were possibly, certainly managers were a little bit afraid because they knew they needed to deliver now.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, well, it's great to see. It is great to see you look at Chelsea's talents, not only at the Blues, but throughout the Premier League. There's so many former Chelsea players, former Chelsea youth players. Good to see. I want to talk about another one of your former clubs, Leicester City, who absolutely battered Newcastle on the weekend 4-0. And I mean, look, there's not too much you can say about Leicester, one of your favourite players, Youri Tielemans, bossing it as usual. But Newcastle, it's not necessarily a game you might expect to win travelling to the King Power, but 4-0, still in relegation. I mean, this is starting to look like trouble for Eddie Howe. He's got Liverpool coming up now midweek.
Yeah.
What have you made of
it? I mean, their fixture list between, you know, the next five fixture lists or something like that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
The feeling I got watching that Leicester game was that a lot of the Newcastle players know that they're only there temporarily. Mm-hmm. They know that there's only a matter of time when January comes around that they'll no longer be in the side. And they're almost, I don't know, it felt, for me, it kind of looked a little bit like there were too many players feeling sorry for themselves.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, if you think about how many games between now and, say, middle of January, there's a lot of games.
Mm.
And that could put them in an extremely difficult position, no matter who they bring in come January.
Yeah, yeah, we'll be watching them very closely, and I think we'll be giving it to Bridgie either way.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm going to bring you back to the local game, Schwartzy, because this one was interesting. I don't know how much you've been keeping tabs with the A-League here. The A-League Men has been well and truly underway now. Some cracking games. And on Saturday night, we had a free-to-wear match, Melbourne against Adelaide. It was a very good game. Three goals, plenty of flair, red cards, everything you could ever want. The concerning thing, and this was a stat that was actually given to me by the guy at Optus Sport, was that there was 40,000 people went through the gates total in round three. This is now attendance at matches. Whether that coincides with free-to-air or whether that is a standard or a suggestion of the quality of the game, is this something for us to worry about, Schwartzy? Because I know in England, it's so, I mean, it's different. We're talking a whole different history, but it's so difficult to watch the games live on TV. So does moving to a free-to-air damage the live atmosphere at the game?
Well, you're certainly going to lose people. There's no doubt about it, because, you know, you want to watch a game. You can go to the pub and watch it. You can watch it at home, have a barbecue, whatever you want. You know, friends over, you can watch it. You don't, without actually leaving and going and making a whole day or half a day experience of it, you know. So I think there's definitely an element of people that are not going to go because it's free, you know, it's free to watch on TV. But just because it's on free to air doesn't mean I believe that the numbers are that low. It's a deep-rooted issue.
Yeah,
you know, there's an issue that's ongoing for a number of years, and they all know it. They all, that, you know, that's one of the reasons why the A-League clubs wanted to take control of the A-League themselves, and it's still, obviously, it's only just happened, right? So they're going to need time.
Yeah.
It's investment. It's advertisement. It's investing in the community grassroots. It's trying to entice people to come to the game. You know, the product is an incredible product. Football itself is an incredible product, as we all know. We love the game. It's incredible. There's an incredible pathway for guys, youngsters coming through, young boys and young girls making a career out of football. There's an incredible opportunity, career paths, something that never existed or existed, but it almost was impossible to achieve when I was growing up as a kid, right? So, and the slightly older I got, it became a little bit more tangible. Now it's very much there. Everybody knows there's a genuine pathway to having a genuinely good career playing football, wherever it is. I just don't think they've utilized it enough. I don't think they've exploited that enough. I don't think they've drummed it home enough. I don't think they've invested in the community enough. I don't think they've engaged in the community enough regarding it. You know, you look at AFL as an incredible example. Why does AFL succeed?
Hmm.
Nowhere else plays it on the planet.
No.
If you think about it in those terms, you know, the same kind of players just being regurgitated. I mean, it's a similar thing to the A-League. Other than the fact is the A-League, you have more opportunities to bring players from abroad, different pools of players, you know, whereas AFL don't.
No.
Yeah. They keep regurgitating the same players at different clubs. You know, there's a system. They've obviously got a method. Obviously, money is a huge asset as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they've done it over such a long period of time. It's the only league on the planet, and they are so successful.
Is that why? Because they're the only league on the planet? Like, does the fact that there's so much football and you can compare quality, you can compare salary, you can compare atmospheres, does that hurt
possibly.
The A-League?
Possibly as well. Yeah, possibly. But I also think you're right. It's the best league in the world. And so, okay, so if you argue and say, right, the Premier League is the best league in the world and look at the fans that are going to the Premier League, you know, so... But then the Bundesliga is a top league. Is it a top five? Probably, yeah. Top five leagues in the world, possibly, yeah. Right? There or thereabouts. They still get phenomenal support. Mm. You know, if you look at Serie A, there's an argument to say, well, actually, the support in stadiums on match days isn't great.
No.
La Liga. Yeah. Some clubs are amazing. Some clubs are just okay. But generally speaking, it's pretty well supported as well. Obviously, the way that AFL do it and the way they hold on to their supporters, they get a full commitment from their supporters.
Yeah.
Whereas football in Australia, for whatever reason, we don't tend to get a full commitment. You get a real hardcore number, but it's a very small hardcore number that are committed. Whereas in AFL, even rugby league to a large degree, there are larger numbers that are fully committed hardcore to their game, to their clubs.
Yeah, there's a real community spirit there. I mean, if you live in Melbourne, if you live in Adelaide, if you live in Perth, you definitely have an AFL team here. Like, you have to. It's part of, like, your father went for them, your grandfather
went
for them.
That's right.
It's part of the culture.
Yeah, that's right. Whereas, obviously, with football fans, it's more about, okay, whether you're from an Italian family, Greek family, whatever you are, English family, or generally Anglo-Saxon Australian, you've probably got a Premier League side, or you've got an Italian team if you're, you know. So it's indoctrinated, like yourself. You've been indoctrinated. It's not your fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you supported Lee. All right?
Oh, Shorty. Yeah, we had to go there. Let's not talk about Italy at the moment, right? Until we've secured passage to the World Cup, I don't want to speak about it. But we're talking about that. You brought up a great point about the marketing. Do you think the biggest thing with the A-League, when you look at it, do you think the problem is from a football approach, or do you think the football's okay? It's everything around the game. It's the marketing, it's the investment, it's the promotion that needs to change. The football itself is moving in the right direction.
Listen, there's always room for improvement. There's no doubt about it. But I think the actual core of the game, the standard, the guts of it is good, right? Mm. Is there, is something. It's something to grab hold of. It's something to promote. It's something to create a story out of. It's something to create a cult following for. Mm. So it probably is more to do with the marketing side, the engagement of clubs within their community, you know, really trying to attach themselves with fans or have fans attach them to the club. Mm. You know, there's almost got to be in some way, they've got to be a better engagement. I don't think there's a good enough engagement. I mean, you know, Melbourne Victory are probably one of the best examples of how it can work. Mm-hmm. But not enough clubs are doing it. Well, certainly none of the other clubs are anywhere near that level from my understanding. I think marketing is certainly one. I mean, listen, let's give them time. You know, they've only just started again. You know, they've only just, you know, it's COVID into the mix as well. But it's not going to happen overnight. No. But they've got to start right from the bottom, and they've got to engage with their fans, with the core fans. They've got to try and create a buzz. They've got to try and create something to draw them in, and not only draw them in, but to hook them up, to hook them into the game, to attach them to the game, that they feel like a huge sense of being part of it and that it's part of the community.
Well, football itself is a potato, right? If you throw a potato in the ground, Schwartzy, what happens?
Oh, it grows.
It grows. It grows anywhere you throw it. So I've always thought football itself is fine. I can sit and watch. You can watch 10-year-olds play against each other, and it's exciting. It's always going to be entertaining as long as the standard is equal. What needs to improve is everything around it. Now, on the weekend, we saw that the A-League trialled for the first time the two managers after the game sitting next to each other in like a UFC boxing style press conference. What I don't know if you saw much of that, but what do you make of it? Trying to start mixing sport with entertainment.
I saw it. Listen, it comes down to the individual in the end, because, you know, we see times, you know, you can imagine it, right? So I don't know, Liverpool are playing against Everton, and you know, it's a bit of a, imagine the game last season when you know, Virgil van Dijk almost got chopped in half by Jordan Henderson. Jordan Pickford.
Yeah.
And could you imagine, you know, Jurgen Klopp being in the press room then with Ancelotti, and the two of them then going at each other regarding the incident? You know, it then becomes a little bit theatrical. It becomes a little bit, almost like Netflix style, real life fly on the wall documentary almost. I mean, I don't know. It depends on the personalities, really.
That's where sports heading. You imagine if Jurgen Klopp and Frank Lampard, after their bust up on the touchline last year, had to then go sit down next to each other.
Absolutely. But then I think you're actually going to lose a lot of that authenticity, that emotion, because I think people will be certainly a lot more reserved when they're sitting there in a press conference with the opposition manager right there. Mm. I think you're going to lose a bit. I don't think there'll be many, I mean, other than the person, depending on the personality, there won't be many coaches who will generally say what they believe.
Mm. Yeah.
Like they would do if it was just them in that press conference.
Okay. Well, you know, they're trying things. Maybe next they're going to go in the 85th minute of the game, two balls. You get a second ball and you play. Who knows? Who knows what's next? I'm all for it, because Schwartzy, I don't know if you saw the AFC league rankings that came out. I'm not sure if you saw this. No, I haven't. Well, I'm not surprised, because I didn't see anything about it on Australian media, and for good reason. But we managed to find this nugget. So you know how they do the same thing in UEFA? They got the league rankings, Premier League's top. Recently, French Liga dropped below the Portuguese League, and that was a bit of news in Europe. The AFC league rankings came out. I'm gonna mention a few countries. You tell me if you think Australia's higher or lower. So, like, I mean, firstly, you'd think the Saudi Arabian Pro League came in at number one. And I think a lot of that's because they've produced the Asian Champions League winner last season. They've got a lot of money flooding through that league. They've attracted a bit of European talent. Now, the Thai League gets in at ninth spot. So you've got the J-League, you've got the Korean League, you've got Chinese League. They're all in the top 10. We didn't make the top 10.
Yep.
Thailand comes in at ninth. In at 11th, Hong Kong. Schwartzy.
Wow.
We're below that one. In at 12th, Tajikistan.
Wow. See, I mean, it's difficult to say, because I wouldn't have a clue about the league in Tajikistan. And just because I don't know it doesn't mean it's not a good, decent level. You know what I mean? I don't know. I really don't know. Nor do you, really. Let's be honest.
Speak for yourself, mate. I tune into the Tajikistani Premier League regularly, Shorty. I'm joking. No, I don't at all. But look, what I was trying to say, we came in at 23rd. Okay, so the Bangladesh League, Lebanon, they were all above us. We came in at 23rd. Now, that's not to say Australia has the 23rd best standard of players. No. We know that's not true. But I think a lot of that comes from the fact that we have no second division, no relegation promotion. We have no these type of structures which add to a league. It's not just the actual standard of football on the pitch. So it's everything you're saying, potentially atmosphere, promotion, all these things are lacking. And
yeah,
we maybe are.
Financial packages as well, the investment in the game itself. I mean, listen, we you know, if you put that into an equation as well, you know, I know the Thai League invest heavily in their players and the type of players that they bring to the clubs over there. It is a professional league, and there's two leagues, I think, at least, that are professional in Thailand. So it is of a good standard. I know that. Probably Malaysia's above Australia as well, isn't it?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, because I know they've got a very good professional league Southeast Asia. That's right, isn't it? Malaysia is in Southeast Asia. That's right. So I can kind of see it. Yeah, I can kind of understand it. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a bit of a stark one, but I think the other thing that affected it was we lost the Champions League place because of it. So now we have one automatic Asian Champions League place. And I find that is one of the biggest things here, because we play a summer competition, and a lot of that comes down to, we don't want to compete with other codes. We don't play at the same time as the Champions League, and we have no success in the Champions League. And it's almost seemed like it's not a priority to these clubs.
I was about to say, my understanding is that most clubs see it as more of a hindrance than a positive being part of the Champions League. Is that fair in saying that? I mean, that's my kind of feeling.
It is, but it's insane to think, because it's when I look at it as a football fan, it's the only thing that separates us from every other code. I mean, if you're at rugby league, if you win the, you know, Roosters win the title, who are you going to go play in the Champions League? You don't have that.
They go and play the winner in England.
Wigan.
Yeah, wherever it is, Leeds, Wigan, whoever it is.
But what we have, what we have is this beautiful opportunity to travel around Asia, to have Asian teams come here to try and compete and be the best and then go to a Club World Cup. Like, I cannot fathom that that is not the priority to win.
I don't either. I mean, as a player, I would have, you know, if I were playing in the A-League and you have an opportunity to play in the Asian Champions League, I'd be absolutely buzzing and I'd be going, like, we've got to go for this and try and win this. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, it's the biggest trophy, club trophy in Asia. So why wouldn't you want to be desperately trying to win it? I don't get it either. I mean, I understand from a club's perspective because I think it, the financial burden is quite severe. So I think it's more about that, isn't it? It's not about whether or not it is a good competition, whether it's prestigious or not. It's more about the financial burden.
Yeah, yeah. Well, lots of work to do, but as you said, it's early days. We have to give benefit of the doubt. We have to be positive about it because there has been a change. And there have been a lot of positives that have kicked off in the first few weeks of the season. So we are enjoying it here, Schwartzy. Before I do let you go, I want to have a bit of fun with you. And we're gonna bring in a new little segment here. I think we've got a little something, a little salt we're going to drop here in a new segment called Who Am I, Schwartzy? This is the first one, and I'm going to drop it with you because it's someone that may be close to home. Gold medalist, Olympian, won at the Sydney 2000 Olympics, played for a few massive clubs in Europe, including two super bitter rivals in Spain, and was a teammate of yours later in his career, was branded an old man by his manager.
Oh, yeah, Samuel Eto'o.
Samuel Eto'o. Why is he in the news at the moment?
Well, he's become now president of the Cameroon Football Association, right?
Absolutely brilliant. He's become the president of the Cameroonian Football Association. You played with him. I've heard a few stories about him and his time at Chelsea, his time at Everton. He was quite a unique character. How was he?
Yeah, no, he was. He was a very unique character. He was someone that certainly wasn't anywhere near as mobile as he was in his younger days, which is understandable. And that's one of the reasons I think Jose had a bit of a laugh about it, a bit of a dig about it. And obviously Samuel didn't take too kindly to it. And he still was phenomenal in front of goal. You know, yeah. His ability, his eye for goal, his technical ability was still sensational. His hunger and desire to still play and to prove people wrong was incredible as well. He was a good guy, mate. He turned up. It's funny because he has this incredible collection of sports cars. And there was always I think it was a silver, like clad, shiny silver Bentley parked at the training ground. And it's just like, Sammy, where's that from? He goes, oh, yeah, just got it brought over from Paris. But why is it here? Oh, yeah, because I'm driving this one today. It was something, I can't remember what car it was. But he had this incredible collection. He goes, oh, yeah, I've got four of them over here. And it was like all these sports cars that were in excess of £150,000, £200,000 each. It was just ridiculous, mate. Absolutely ridiculous. I mean, he told us a story, actually, when he was at Anji in Russia. and basically when he signed, that he got a phenomenal deal to go and sign for them. And he was telling a story about the suitcase that came with it and what it was filled with. And it was just insane.
Really?
The figure was incredible.
Oh, God. Just for a sign-on bonus?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was out of this world.
Yeah.
They were mind-boggling.
Really?
Yeah. And it was just like, Sammy, what'd you do? Just walk. Picked it up and put it back in the plane and flew back to Paris.
Well, he when he was playing there, he lived in Moscow and had a private jet to training, apparently.
He did, yeah, apparently, because they say that it wasn't the nicest place in the world to be and to live in. So they would fly in and play the games or fly in, I think, the day before maybe and trained or something like that. I'm not really sure.
Wow.
And it was an incredible time, wasn't it? I mean, the club were spending fortunes at that time. And I want to say fortunes. I mean, up there and probably above of what a lot of these Chinese Super League sides were paying players.
Yeah, and then that's not including the suitcases that you get upon arrival.
Yes.
What a man, Samuel Eto'o. What a striker. What a career he had. Back-to-back Champions Leagues and all the rest. Teammate with Mark Schwarzer. And I do remember him bagging a hat-trick in that season against Man United as well. So he still had it at that old age. And now he's head of the Cameroonian FA. Maybe we'll see him in actual government sued. We saw George Weah do it in Liberia, and he went from a position.
I wouldn't put it past him at all. There's two former players, teammates of mine that I could see doing it. Sami Etou is one of them, and obviously Didier Drogba is the other one.
Yeah.
That's almost a shoo-in to somewhere along the line to be in a place of power very, very soon.
It's unbelievable the effect that footballers have in their home countries there, because they, of course, have the opportunity to go to Europe, make so much money and make a significant change back home as well.
Yeah, I think it's more about their connection still with back home and how much they do to try and help the underprivileged, help back in their homelands.
Yeah.
Certainly with Didier Drogba, I know that, you know, he was very, very passionate about doing what he could to help, you know, people back home in his country.
Yeah, yeah. It's awesome to see. Love these guys. Moving on to bigger and better things. Shorty, we've got midweek football coming up on Optus Sports. Some cracking games. I'm going to fly through a couple. I want your predictions, because I love doing this to you, because if you get them wrong, I'm going to bring them back up next week. First one, Man City Leeds.
Well, last season we saw Leeds go to City and win, didn't we?
Yeah.
An incredible performance. I can't see it happening again. Sorry, Leeds. I mean, they're nowhere near that right now, and City just look... I don't say look awesome. They just look almost. They just look incredibly good. They look like, it's not like a couple of seasons ago when you watch Man City and went, they are unbelievable to watch. Yeah. They're like the most. It's the best football to watch. It's the best team on the planet to watch. They just are so good. Wherever, all over the pitch, and they just go about their job. And sometimes they go about their job quietly, and they go and just win games and do what they have to do to win games. They just seem to be doing it time and time again. And for some reason, they've flown under the radar a little bit this season.
Yeah, they have.
This point.
Which is frightening. I don't like that. I don't like when the spotlight's too much on Chelsea. And
I know.
Yeah, yeah. But the other big game, I love this one, Arsenal-West Ham. It's a huge opportunity for Arsenal to really be contenders, right?
I'm at that game doing some work. On the radio, actually. So I'm at the game at the Emirates. Arsenal West Ham. Oh gosh, I mean West Ham. You'd be mad to predict anything against. I mean, even though they've stumbled a little bit of late, I fancy West Ham going there and getting a result.
Well, they have
such contrasting. I'm not going to say they're
going to win. Yeah,
I think they're going to get a result.
They have such contrasting records against the top six, because Arsenal have been terrible against the top teams, whereas West Ham, that's when they've gotten most of their points, are against the top teams this season. So they seem to step up to that.
They do. One thing that West Ham have is incredible commitment and togetherness. And that's obviously the one big question for Arsenal, and still always has been. Well, certainly, when I say always has been for a number of years now.
Yeah.
And, I think West Ham will go there and get a result.
Yeah. The last one I wanted to ask you about, Liverpool up against Newcastle. Oh, I mean, it's... How many goals?
You just want me to say Liverpool's going to win, because they're going to win, and they're going to win comfortably. I mean, I can see this being a 4 or 5-0 easily.
Yeah.
Listen, if Leicester can destroy Newcastle 4-0, Liverpool could win 6 easily.
Yeah, yeah.
Liverpool are phenomenal, and they've been incredible up until this point in the season. And it'll all be dependent. How Liverpool finish the season will depend on how long Salah and Mane are away in January.
Yeah, yeah, that's going to be ridiculous.
That's going to be the unfortunate bit, because I think that could be the bit that costs Liverpool. That's the only bit. If those two were still there, then you can throw a hat over the three of them, that any one of the three could win it.
Well, it was interesting, because that came up on Premier League Today yesterday. I was on there and they were talking about the fact that Riyad Mahrez is the only player City are losing, which is a phenomenal player, but they've got so many replacements there.
Yes.
Chelsea losing Mendy. Is that just as big as losing a Salah or a Mane?
No.
Okay.
No.
Kepa can come in.
It's a big loss, but Kepa's stepped up, right? So Mendy's been phenomenal, right? He's been incredible for Chelsea. And contributing to the clean sheets, how many games has Mendy himself won points for Chelsea?
Mm-hmm.
Not as many as Salah and Mane have won for Liverpool in the same period of time that Mendy's been at the club. Because people say, oh yeah, Mendy has only been at Chelsea for a short period of time, whereas Salah and Mane have been for a long time. But in the same period of time, certainly Salah has been hugely influential to Liverpool winning time and time again.
Yeah.
Whereas Mendy has played a part, but had Kepa been in goal, would they have won the game? Possibly. Maybe the odd one or two not, but generally speaking, yes.
It's just another spanner. The African Cup of Nations is just another exciting spanner in the works of what already is a remarkable season. We've got midweek football coming up on Optus Sport. Make sure you check in with it. We don't even know what the storylines are going to be. Everything can change in 24 hours. The latest we've heard is that Man United's training was shut down today due to some COVID cases. So will they play? Spurs could be back in action against Leicester. Chelsea up against the struggling Rafa Benitez. So there's so many storylines to come out of the midweek football. Probably none bigger than the fact that myself and Mark Schwarzer were left alone by Michael Bridges, who I don't know if you've seen this, but he's blowing up our group chat at the moment, Schwartzy. He's out on the town. Happy birthday to Kate Bridges, his wife, but he's missed it today, and we need to call him out on that one.
He has missed it, and there was no excuse other than, oh, I got the times wrong and the days wrong, and I'm sorry. But actually, 10 minutes in, he goes, I found a corner. I can do it from a corner in the room. We just both blanked him, obviously.
I looked down. I was like, he cannot be serious. Can you imagine, Bridgie? Who knows how you know how big this night has been for him? Can you imagine getting involved?
Listen, Bridgie's been having tea all night. He's not been drinking anything else other than tea.
Yeah, of course. Up there in Newcastle, we know how they are. We'll leave it there. Schwartzy, you've been fantastic anyway, though. Enough for three of the superstars. Thanks very much for joining me. It's been great to chat all things football from around Europe and Australia. Guys, you can catch everything you need on Optus Sport. We'll see you same time next week, hopefully with a few more guests. But until then, have a great week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.